When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, hey, it's your fourth cousin, twice removed, Allie Ward, back with a familial historical episode of Ologies. So you are here because people made babies with each other. And out of all of the gametes and all of the gonads, you became a collection of molecules and you're suspended in a web of family. Even a cockroach technically has grandparents and cousins. Isn't that weird? Your cat might have an uncle. And if you have children, gaze at them. They may have children who have children. And then those children's might not even know your damn name. They'll just know you're dead. But before we get into it, first, a quick thank you to the select slice of listeners who are also patrons. You know who you are. You make the show possible. Thank you to everyone spreading the word with your mouth or with your tweets or by wearing my face on your chest via ologiesmerch.com. Thanks to everyone who boosts the show for others to see by hitting subscribe and rating it. That actually works. And leaving reviews like sweet, sweet Tyra Mail for me to see, such as this fresh evaluation from DC Doppelganger, who says, feeling sad and monotonous, life getting you down. Listen to this podcast. Ologies reminds you about how amazing the world around you actually is. Thanks, Dad Ward. Stay curious, everyone. Will do, DC. I promise. Okay. Genealogy. The first topic ever to not be an ology. Look at it. Genealogy? What is this? The Berenstain Bears? It's an allergy? What the heck, man? So genealogy comes from the root word gene, meaning to give birth to, like Genesis. And genealogy is not the study of genetics and how DNA works. That's just called genetics. So this was news to me. Now, genealogy is the tracing of family origins. And in Old English, it was called folktalu, meaning folktales. But the ology and not ology is because the O in ologies is borrowed from the first word anyway. So my point is that this podcast should actually just be called Lochies. And to be honest, I'm not really emotionally prepared to process that. Also, it was taking my laptop 150 episodes to not correct this, my life's work, into eulogies or logies, which it's done in business emails. So now we know the ology is as good as an ology. So this week's allergist, I suppose, has been in this field for 3 decades, starting as a personal passion that just consumed him into making it a job. And I was introduced to him by someone who worked to publish his latest book, which is called 1619-20 Africans, which just came out this past July. And I immediately ordered the book. I was so happy he was down to pop into a sound booth in Portland to chat with me about his passion, tracing family histories and chasing down records, and also about mystery novels and capes, questions you should ask your relatives, U.S. history and how we treat the past, how to heal from our individual legacies, the joy of cracking a case, DNA tests, technology, brunch revelations, and how everywhere you look, there's family. So pull up a chair and absorb the stories of 2-time author, total peach, distant relative to Tom Hanks, and perhaps your relative as well, genealogist Stephen Hanks. I'm sure you get that with a lot of Stevens.
I do. Yeah. And my name is spelled with a PH, as you probably noticed. And
yes.
But when it's funny, when I introduce myself, they say Steve. Okay, Steve, nice to meet you. Steve, or is it Steven?
And now you are a genealogist.
Yes.
And yes. You've been a genealogist for quite a while now.
Yeah, I started like in 89. Yeah, mm-hmm. When I was like, God, how old was I? I was... about 30 years old, and that's, I got the bug. I was over at my dad's house that day in summer, July, and he was watching the baseball game, and
he handed me this letter that he got from a cousin in Kansas, and he says, read this. And, of course, I didn't know anything about my family's history. You know, I'm just a kid growing up in Portland, Oregon. And so he shows me this letter. I started reading it, and it's an obituary out of a newspaper, and all these relatives' names are listed in this obituary. And it's on my dad's side of the family. And I just said, wow, I don't know who these people are. And that's what got it started right there. I said, I got to find out who these people are. I got to find out about the history of my family. And so that's how it got started. 89. Yeah.
And what was the first thing you did back in 89? We had libraries and microfiche and the Dewey Decimal System.
Yes. No microfilm readers. Yeah. The microfiche. Yes. Totally. Totally. No internet, no clicking of the mouse. You know, it was old school all the way.
And old school ways involved making the 2 to 3 hour drive from Portland to Seattle's National Archives. And that houses 58,000 cubic feet of records. That's a lot of records. All about the Pacific Northwest for Oregon, Idaho, Washington, and now Alaska. But just in the past few weeks, this is breaking news, historians are rightly PO'd that the government wants to sell this building because the techie Seattle location has become so valuable. And a building sale would mean moving all of those records of the Pacific Northwest to Missouri or California, making the journey for people much longer and, let's face it, mostly impossible. And no, you can't just jump on the information superhighway. A lot of those ledgers and records haven't even been digitized. So genealogy research, like family trees, still has its roots in the past.
Well, when I started getting interested in this field and wanting to learn more, I had to learn the rules of the game and how the professional genealogists did it. And so I learned about census records, tax records, you know, land deeds and all that sort of thing, courthouse records, and just on and on and on, museums. So I said, well, let me start with the census records. That sounds pretty easy enough. You know, every 10 years they have a census. And of course, they put a privacy restriction on the first 70 years. They don't release it to the public. So the most recent census that was available to me at that time was, I believe, the 1920 census. Yeah, 1920. Mm-hmm. But they had no National Archives branch in Portland. I could either fly to Washington, D.C. Well, that probably wasn't going to work. Yeah. Or they said you could go to Seattle, Washington. They have a branch there. So I would just take off whenever I could and just drive up 3 hours up to Seattle and just spend time looking at the old microfilm reels and putting the old microfilm on, you know, cranking the machine, and boom, there they were. I found my grandparents in Manhattan, Kansas. I started getting excited in 1920. And the genealogist rule, this is the genealogist rule, Allie, is work your way back from what you know to what you don't know. That's the rule. Never do it the other way around. Never go to what you don't know and try to work your way up to the present, because you don't know who those people are in the past, right? Yes. So you don't know what journey or what path you're going to be on. So start with what you know and work your way back. So I found my grandparents' names. I said, okay, I'm on the right track. And just started working my way back. But it started getting tricky as you get, you know, further back in time. And that's what even got me more excited, because, you know, I'm like a detective, you know, like the Perry Mason, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just start looking under the rocks. And so went to 1910, the 1900 census. And this was really getting exciting. I finally was able to locate my great grandparents, knew their names, and it just blew me away. You know, found them in Kansas and found out that they had moved to Kansas from Mississippi. And the thing about that experience was they came from Mississippi under a different set of living, as you know where I'm coming from, you know, slavery, you know, kind of the slavery thing. So that was a big shockeroo. But
Stephen's first book was 2013's A Key Tree, A Descendant's Quest for His Slave Ancestors on the Eskridge Plantations. And he has such an amazing way of writing about the process of genealogy through his own narrative and how one discovery can kind of ignite another.
The further you go back in time, I was able to find them on the 1880 census. And the 1890 census, I guess, was burned in a fire in 1921.
Oh, wow.
So that's, yeah, that's something that all genealogists, if you're studying Greek, Italian, whatever your, you know, ancestry is, that's something that you have to live with. The 1890 census is gone forever.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Stephen told me that through the 1870 census, he discovered that his grandparents lived in a little town called Duck Hill, Mississippi, hailing from what is now Montgomery County, the same place that Oprah Winfrey's family is from. Small world, but big deal, given that Oprah Winfrey is like the closest thing this country has had to a queen.
There they were, 1870, June something. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. There they were.
Oh,
never met these family members, but these were my ancestors. And so when I got to that point, I was just in heaven, you know. But the problem is you know, you going beyond 1870 is the trick for, you know, as far as African-American genealogy. But I enjoyed, you know, doing it for, I've had many different clients, many different people, just even friends that I've done it for all type of different Italian, Greece, so forth. So it's exciting.
And you've established yourself as a genealogist. You've written multiple books. You've consulted on multiple documentaries. And, you know, going back a little bit to your own history, were you always someone who liked mystery novels, like detective novels? Like what?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Was that kind of in your genes?
Oh, my God. Sherlock Holmes. I can remember as a kid just staying up late at night and just watching the Sherlock Holmes with who was the guy that was playing that? But yeah, you know, it always had to be this one actor that played Sherlock Holmes. He was the one that I fell in love with. I can't remember his name right off the bat. But
oh, look it up. My guess is that this is Ronald Howard, who in nearly 40 episodes of Detective Capers portrayed the caped icon.
What are you doing anyway?
Research.
Research?
P.S. Side note, I just learned that cape is called an Inverness cape, and it's named after a rainy region in the Scottish Highlands, where Scottish wear this sleeveless cloak thing because it allows for easier access to their sporran, which is their long, hairy fanny pack coin purse that hangs over their junk area. Anyway, yes, Sherlock Holmes loved a good problem to solve, and on the topic of clever Scots.
But I loved him. Sherlock was my guy. And then, of course, you know, James Bond. I mean, who's not going to like James Bond? You know, the Sean Connery.
I know. I love you, James.
But yeah, I totally was into the mysteries and the detectives early on. Definitely. For sure.
And after you were handed this obituary and you started driving up to Seattle to look in the archives, you mentioned you're in your 30s. Have you been able to balance genealogy with other careers, or did at some point did you have to decide what you were going to dedicate your career to?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I did have to kind of juggle back and forth because I had, you know, the passion and the drive to want to be a genealogist. I tried to start up my own business. Actually, I did start my own business. It was called Genealogical Networking Services, and I went back to school and learned how to do computers because I didn't know that. So I started up my own little entrepreneurship, and I was getting requests all across the country. It was amazing. It was amazing. I still have those inquiry letters to this day, and they were all over the country. People asking me to do this, that. Can you look this up? Native American, just anything you could think of. And I had fun doing it. The only problem was people had a tendency to not want to pay you, but they want you to do the research first, and then, okay, now send me a payment. So it got to be kind of hard to make a living out of it, but I always had the passion for it. So had to do other type of work just to, you know, pay the bills type thing. But finally, I was able to, just recently, actually, 5 years ago, I finally got a really nice job that goes right along with my genealogy. I'm working for the school district here. And yeah, I'm a records clerk, and it's amazing how many people come in walk-in or email or phone. They want to do research about this, that, and the other, and that's just right up my alley, doing research. Oh. And it ties right into the genealogy. So for the first time after so many years, I finally got, you know, they both together, genealogy and just doing historical research, you know, and local research. So it's cool.
Oh, that's amazing. And, you know, I know that you chronicled these discoveries that you made with your family in your first book, The Akitri. And I would love to hear more. I know it's the Akitri or Akitri. You can pronounce it either way.
I know. I say Akitri, and then I've heard people say, no, Aki, you know. And
so, I know. I wasn't quite sure, so I just messed it up either way.
Right. But I guess it's my auntie, who she just recently passed away in St. Louis, Missouri, but she was my mother's sister, and she would take trips to Jamaica, you know, as often as she could. And so she pronounced it Aki, and she sent me a picture of it, and I put it in the book.
So the Akitri, or Akitri, depending on how you say it, is native to West Africa, and it bears this red fruit that in due time yawns open to reveal dark black glossy seeds and this yellow spongy flesh. And it's popular in Caribbean dishes. But if you try to eat that sucker before it's ripe, your impatience might get rewarded with the very self-explanatory Jamaican vomiting sickness. Anyways, let it ripen and then cook it with cod, and it's just supposed to be heaven on earth. Now, Stephen's book, The Akitri, has sepia-toned photographs of his ancestors and the silhouette of this tree behind them. And he told me that his first book was narrative fiction based on his family experiences and inspired by books like Alex Haley's Roots. But later he revised it to be purely nonfiction.
It took about 10 years to do the research on that. And my whole goal when I first started out was just to learn about my family on both my sides, my father and mother's side. I wasn't trying to like go all the way to Africa or anything like that. Just learning about the family. But every time I would go further back in history, I kept getting excited. I'm like, how far back can I go?
This
is getting to be interesting now. I mean, because as we all know, you know, Abraham Lincoln, he ended slavery. We know that in 1865 or 1863, some say, because the Emancipation Proclamation. And I, like I had mentioned to you earlier, I found my parents or my great-grandparents on the 1870 census. That was the first time, Allie, that African-Americans were listed on a federal census for the first time, as far as everyone.
Yeah.
Because it was 5 years after the end of the Civil War. And so now everyone was just, you know, a regular citizen now, the way it was supposed to be. So, but if you want to go further back, 1860, well, then you're going back into the old system of things, you know, when the South was at its peak and cotton was king and all that. So 1860, that's when you really get into the struggle of trying to identify who your parents are and your ancestors, I should say. Now, for some people, they have what they call free people of color. I learned about that as I became a genealogist. There were some people who had the designation of they were a free person of color, meaning they were emancipated or they were set free long time ago, maybe 1800s. And their family just were free all the way up and right through the Civil War, everything. They were just cruising. They were free. And so they never had that problem of being found on a census record because their family had always been free.
Free people of color, by the by, are referred to as free people of color. And just the distinction is a very painful reminder that they were the exception and not the rule. Stephen explored the beginnings of the laws that would shape and scar the nation for the last 400 years in his book, 1619, 20 Africans, their story and discovery of their black, red, and white descendants.
But in Hampton, Virginia, there was a little ship that came in August of 1619, and it had 20 Africans on it, and they were taken off of a slave ship that was heading to Mexico, Veracruz, Mexico, and some pirates attacked the ship and took about 50 Africans off of the slave ship. And it's a true story. And 20 of them came to the coast of Virginia, Hampton, Virginia. And they let him go. They traded him for food. And long story short, I did this book based on this, and DNA is so interesting now too. Everyone is taking a DNA test, trying to find out about their ancestry. You know, we have TV shows about it.
Please see Finding Your Roots, Genealogy Roadshow, Faces of America, and Who Do You Think You Are? The latter of which, fun fact, is produced by Lisa Kudrow, aka Phoebe from Friends. And she even did an episode on Courtney Cox and...
Okay, and she was hoping that, you know, her family were good people and no one, like, murdered anyone. And it turns out her ancestors murdered the King of England.
I looked into this further and a red-hot poker may have been involved, but we don't need to go into it. Anyway, part of discovering one's genealogy is facing that, guess what? Just because they're your ancestors doesn't mean that they're the protagonist of the story. So it's easy as a white person to think that, say, Black History Month doesn't involve you. But if you live in America, it does. It involves all of us. And with knowledge comes context, and with context comes understanding. And DNA tests are expanding that knowledge more and more.
It's just phenomenal. And so I took my DNA test and come to find out that I have some connections to these first Africans. So that's what this latest book is about. And so the further you go back in time, it just gets harder and harder to locate your family if you were, if your, you know, if your ancestry or your inheritance was slavery. But it can be done. It can be done.
And I'd love to hear more about your personal family discovery and what that was like for you when you were tracing your genealogy, tracing your family history, and you made that discovery that you had obviously relatives who were slaves in the South. What was that like for you?
Wow. Yeah.
To connect.
It was amazing. I interviewed so many different relatives, so many different cousins. Most of my father's side had passed away, but my mom's was still around. But it was just amazing just interviewing people. But then, as we mentioned earlier, we didn't have the internet back in those days. So you can't just get on Google and, you know, type in a web search and click on a document and you know, print out your family tree. It doesn't work that way. So I had to travel around. I didn't go fly, but I would get on the Greyhound bus and I would just travel to Mississippi, to Kansas. I went to Virginia, South Carolina, just interviewing people, going to courthouses. And I'll never forget this day, Allie, September 22nd, 1994. I'll never forget that day. That was the day that I took a trip down to Duck Hill, Mississippi, to meet the great-granddaughter of the man who my ancestors worked for. It was deep. Yeah, we corresponded over the phone, and she said she'd be happy to meet me, her and her husband. And I told her about my book and that I'm trying to write this information. I'm trying to research my family, and I just would like to know where my ancestors lived and where they worked at, and the land and just everything about it. I just wanted to breathe it, touch it, smell it, whatever. I wanted to get down there and see that. She says, come on down. You just let us know when you come in and we'll meet you. So I planned my trip, went down there in September 1994, and we met at the local bank there. It's a little small town, and we just embraced, and we just embraced, and we just made a really deep connection. We're still friends to this day. Well, actually, her son and his wife are friends with me because she's now passed on. She was about 75 years old in 1994, but she just opened her arms, and I had to rent a car, and I drove up from Jackson, Mississippi, rented a car, drove up the Interstate 55 and got into town there. And she hopped into my car. She didn't know me from Adam. The first time we met, you know, she hopped into the passenger side, and her daughter drove her up there. And she tells her daughter, okay, I'll see you later on today. Goodbye, bye. And she just, she's that confident to get into the car with me, a total stranger. Mm-hmm. But that's the connection we had that day. It was amazing. It was amazing. I'll never forget it. And she took me to the old family site, the old plantation home that her great-grandfather lived in. And she took me to the family cemetery. And some of my ancestors were buried in her family cemetery. It was just amazing. And
Just a side note, I was casually fully crying in my recording closet at this point.
I just was taking notes the whole time, and that was a turning point, and that just broke through to finding another generation of my family. And long story short, Allie, by the time it was said and done, I was able to work my way all the way from starting in 1920 and went all the way back to like the 1700s.
Oh my God.
1730s. Yeah. Couldn't believe it. I had no idea that I could go that far back, but I had paper documents from the courthouses and estate records that I just followed the paper trail, you know, just like, you know, Perry Mason and Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. Said. Follow the paper trail.
I heard you had a reputation for resourcefulness.
So Stephen followed those clues, and it led him to Virginia in the 1730s and an archived estate inventory.
You know, when somebody dies, they have to do an estate inventory,
right,
of all your property. And they did that back then too. Nothing, you know, pretty much the same. And so this person's plantation home that this paper trail pointed me to, his name was Colonel George Eskridge. And he had Africans that were working on he had a tobacco plantation. Tobacco was mm-hmm. the main crop, I guess, at that time. And he had on his estate inventory when he died in 1735, they had to do an estate inventory of all his belongings. And of course, unfortunately, they listed, human beings as property at
human
that time.
Beings, okay, yeah.
We get that, you know, that's how they did. But they were African names. When I looked on the inventory, they were African names. I couldn't believe it. And so through a little bit of more research, I was able to identify one of them. And it was just amazing. Just amazing.
You've had a long history of going into, you know, musty bookshelves and microfiche and all the way up to internet into DNA tests and, you know, genealogy. The field expands, it seems like, you know, every year with technology. And
yes,
on one hand, you know, we learn that we're literally like all related. But on the other, it uncovers some really painful truths. Yes. About our histories and about slavery and about colonialism. How do you feel as a genealogist that can affect us emotionally? Do you think that can bring up pain, or do you think it can help heal something, or is it empowering?
I think that initially it does cause a little bit of pain and uncomfortableness, because for some reason in our country of, you know, America, United States of America, I don't think we've fully ever grappled with what happened after 1865. I don't think we ever really had any discussions about race and, that topic. I just don't think we ever really dealt with it. And because there were so many things that came on right after, you know, okay, slavery ended, everybody's celebrating, da, da, da. And then, boom, we had a whole set of other problems that came right after that, you know, with Jim Crow and segregation and the KKK and on and on and on and on. And so we never really dealt with it. And so I kind of look at it like this here. It's just like a person that's maybe has an addiction. You know, maybe have an addiction with alcohol or drug addiction or whatever it is. The first step is acknowledging that you have a problem. And then you discuss it with someone and you try to get help. And the more you discuss it and you acknowledge it, it starts to heal you and you start to feel better.
Stephen notes that South Africa's post-apartheid public hearings held by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which it was then called, allowed victims of abuses and violence to speak out and explain the physical and emotional impacts of apartheid. And it also gave those who perpetrated violence a chance to ask for amnesty and forgiveness. Stephen thinks that having a similar healing process in America could lead to better understanding, compassion, and healing.
If you study your roots and you find that you have people that are in your family that are of a different ethnicity or a different culture, embrace it and get to know who they are. Reach out to them and introduce yourself. And, you know, because they're your family, you know, they're your family. And the DNA test that's so popular now, that people are finding that out more and more, that we're all so more closely connected than we ever have been, because we're all related, really, when you look at it, you know. And so it is painful at first. But just acknowledging that we had a problem, but that we want to move forward and just be in peace. And that's one thing about doing genealogy for me, is that I have to look at it. It is a little emotional sometimes, but I have to put that aside and put that in one little compartment and look at it from the perspective of, this is history. And I want to learn about history. I want to learn about people. And because we're all the same. And so if we do that, you know, we're going to do fine. We're going to be fine.
The time for the healing of the wounds has come.
How has the advent of, you know, consumer DNA tests changed what you do and how you research?
It's very interesting. It's a very interesting question. When I first took the test and got the results back, and all these, I had like about, I think it was like 2,000, at least about 2,000 connections of people that were related to me. And they did it from, obviously, from the highest ratio down to the lowest ratio. And so I could look at my top 20, you know, and I say, wow, these are really close to me.
So Stephen has taken two DNA tests, and his father, before he passed away, also took one. And their raw data led them to the Eskridge family name he was already familiar with, which validated the technology for him. He was like, oh, this works. But sometimes results might surprise you. Turns out that iconic Lizzo's iconic Truth Hurts genealogical ripper.
I just took a DNA test. Turns out I'm 100% that bitch.
Isn't 100% her brainchild. So a London musician with the handle Mina Linus tweeted that exact line in February 2017, and then it became a meme, and Lizzo liked the meme. She tossed it in a song. And the original tweeter was like, hello, excuse me, Lizzo, that is my DNA joke. And some legal things ensued, but fences have been mended. And fast forward to October when Mina tweeted out, quote, I just took a DNA test. Turns out I'm a credited writer for the number one song on Billboard. All's well that ends well.
And I'm getting ready to take another DNA test here shortly, because there are so many companies out there and people are choosing which companies they want to do it with. So either my cousins haven't taken the test on the companies that I took it with, or they haven't taken one at all. Or it could mean that my family that I thought was my family, maybe they weren't my family, you know? You never know.
If you take a DNA test through 23andMe, say, but then you have relatives who have taken it through, like, Ancestry, does that mean that you just might be, like, not connecting because you're using different companies?
Exactly. And that's the point, is that I want to take another test through another company. Actually, I do want to take it through Ancestry, because I think that a lot of more of my family, in fact, I know I've heard that more of my cousins are taking it on the Ancestry one. So I want to get on board and just see how I line up with that. So, but 23andMe, it's a great company. I've gotten a lot of good hits and connections with that. That did validate that this DNA stuff is for real, because I did know their names, and they did show up, and they were on my mother's side, but not on my father's side showed up.
How does that work? And I might have to look this up, but how does that work with, like, the mitochondrial Eve and things coming down from the X chromosomes? Like, do we tend to find out more about our maternal sides when we take DNA tests than we do paternal? Mitochondrial Eve, side note, has become the pop cultural name of the most recent known maternal ancestor that we all share, because mitochondrial DNA is only passed on through maternal lineage. Scientists do not love this biblical name, as it's misleading from a narrative standpoint, let's say. But this mitochondrial Eve is what's called an MRCA, most recent common ancestor. And she can vary depending on genetic discoveries. So if a more recent common ancestor lineage is discovered, for example, It's a different mitochondrial Eve. But yes, all related. All of us. Wild.
For a female that wants to do genealogy and using the DNA tool, to in order for them to learn more about their father's side, they need to try to see if they have a brother that can take the test, or their father, or an uncle, you know, anyone on the paternal side.
This, side note, is called a Y chromosome test, and it's helpful to figure out, say, if two families with the same surname are indeed genetic relatives. So, ladies, surprise your dad or brother with a DNA test. It's a gift that just keeps giving you information. And then, of course, there's the mitochondrial DNA test you can do. Everyone has their mom's mitochondrial DNA, and this is helpful because historically, women's history can be erased, or at least very illegibly smudged by the taking of surnames. More on that later. Oh, and you can get single nucleotide polymorphism testing, which scans your DNA for variations in the CG and AT pairings. And they'll tell you what traits or diseases, or in some cases, parents you might share with folks in their database.
And that's another thing too about these genealogy, these DNA companies, is they're always updating their results. The results get updated because more and more people are joining them, and so they're getting more hits. The DNA results keep updating, and you get more and more people that join, and you get new names that just keep popping up, and so, hey.
That's got to be the best email to get, because I get those from 23andMe that'll be like, you have new relatives, because my family's Catholic on both sides, which means there's a million of us.
Oh, okay. And, You took your test through 23andMe?
Yeah, really? I did. And I have so many relatives. Wow. And my dad's one of 11. My mom's one of 6. So we got a lot of us out there. And but that's got to be the most exciting email to pop up in your inbox, is that you have new relatives.
Yes, totally. Yeah. Totally.
You've got to be like, jackpot.
Man, totally. Yes.
And I actually, I told our listeners that I was going to be talking to you today, and they sent in questions. Can I ask you some questions from
absolutely,
them?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, great. Like literally hundreds of questions for you.
Oh my God.
I know. Wow. Everyone's so excited. Okay, but before we dive into your genealogical queries, as you know, each episode we donate to a relevant charity, and one that Stephen advocates for is blackpast.org. And BlackPast is dedicated to providing a global audience with reliable and accurate information on the history of African America and people of African ancestry around the world. And they aim to promote greater understanding through this knowledge and to generate constructive change in our society. They have over 6,000 pages of genealogical resources and history available, and again, are at blackpast.org. So that donation was made possible by some sponsors of the show, which you may hear about now.
Warmer, sunnier days are calling. Do you know what that means? It means I won't be making soup over a hot stove. I will be making Factor, because they are fresh, never frozen meals that are dietitian approved. They're ready to eat in just 2 minutes. And watch out, they're delicious. I was like, are they really as good as people say? I have some neighbors. One of them's a nurse. One of them is a firefighter. And yes, they're both as attractive as they sound. They're like, yeah, we love Factor meals. And I was like, I bet you do. You're gorgeous. Boom. Tried them. I was like, these are delicious. They're also good for days when I'm lazy. They have 35 different meals. You'll always have new flavors to explore. I have never had a Factor meal that I've been like, nah. They've all been so good. Restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon and shrimp and blackened salmon. Also way more healthy and less expensive than takeout or ordering in. So there you go. Trust my hot neighbors. Head to factormeals.com/ologies50 and use the code ologies50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code ologies50 at factormeals.com/ologies50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Bon appetit. You're welcome. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Listen, we're all carrying around just a backpack of stressors and sadnesses. When we keep them all zipped up and the load gets heavier, it can start to affect us negatively. You start to feel misunderstood, sad, resentful. A safe place to unpack that is, you guessed it, therapy. Therapists can help you dump out your bag and work through the heavy garbage that's weighing you down, in my case at least. I've used BetterHelp. They have definitely helped me understand that pushing my feelings down does not actually make them go away. It makes them feel worse. So if you've been thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient and flexible. It's suited to your schedule. You fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. It's so much faster and easier than trying to hunt down a therapist from just online listings and cold calling. That's one thing I love about BetterHelp. And if for any reason you're not vibing with your therapist, you can switch anytime, no additional charge, no drama. So unburden yourself and trauma dump onto someone who's trained for this. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ologies today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ologies. Oh, KiwiCo. We love you. Kids love you. Parents love you. Uncle Allies love you. Here's the deal. So whether you're staying at home or you're heading out on some summer explorations, KiwiCo is inviting kids, also kids at heart, that's you, to enjoy their first ever summer adventure series. So kids from 2 years old to teens can receive 6 hands-on science and art project kits over 6 weeks. They have something for everyone. They have different topics for each age, whether your kid wants to explore space or learn about dinosaurs. And I've heard from my parental friends that summer can be a little challenging to keep the kiddos busy. KiwiCo's like, we did the legwork for you. And the Summer Adventure Series is this personalized experience with super fun activities like a bottle rocket kit where kids can build an actual bottle rocket. And you can either receive all of your summer adventure crates at once or weekly for 6 weeks. I think it's so amazing that they have different crates for different ages, everything from the great outdoors that has like giant bubbles or a window garden to a trebuchet kit for ages 9 to 14, an entrepreneur where you can do textured clay projects. If you have kids, if you know kids, keep them occupied and learning and having fun this summer with KiwiCo. And you can get 20% off your summer adventure series at kiwico.com/ologies summer. That's 20% off your summer adventure at kiwico.com/ologies summer. Oh, have fun. Oh, it's heating up. It's time to say bye now to your jackets and your sweaters and your tights and get reacquainted with shorts and tees, breezy things. Can I point you to the direction of Quince? What I love about Quince, you can build a lineup of timeless pieces. They keep you looking effortlessly chic year after year without spending a fortune. They have premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts. They start at $30. They have washable silk tops. And I love that all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands because they partner directly with top factories. They cut out the cost of the middleman and then they pass the savings on to you. So whether you need a sundress you can wear to a picnic or you need some good t-shirts or tanks that feel nice on your skin and are well made, head over to Quince. I love them so much I put them on my body. That's what clothes are for. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/ologies for free shipping on your order and 365 day returns. That's quince.com/ologies to get free shipping and 365 day returns. quince.com/ologies. Okay, let's hop into your questions.
And so let's see. First, Patreon question. This was asked by Rachel Kasha, Jennifer Tran, and first time question asker, Danielle Lavoie, asked, what's the deal with second cousins versus first cousins once removed? Rachel Kasha says the whole once removed hurts my brain and I don't understand. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. Well, I'll take the first part because that's easier.
Okay.
The second cousins, would be, like you have your first cousin, like mm-hmm. say you have your mother has a sister, which would be your aunt, and your aunt has children, mm-hmm. and those children would be your first cousins.
Cousins
twice removed and all that. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that.
That makes you feel better because. Yeah. If a genealogist who's like published several books and is like a consultant for PBS shows doesn't quite get it, that makes me feel so much better.
Oh, my. Yeah, I tell you.
Okay, side note. I looked up a flow chart for this and my soul hurt, but I think I got it. So your first cousin's child is your first cousin once removed. So your first cousin's kids are first cousins twice removed. So removed is in regard to generations. So same grandparents,
different generation. Now, your second cousin, according to genealogy.com, is someone who has the same great-grandparents as you, but not the same grandparents. So third cousins have the same great-great-grandparents, fourth cousins have the same great-great-great-grandparents, and so on. So that cousin removed business is about generations, unlike on my Italian side, feuds, blistering, family-shattering feuds. In my family, my dad's, you know, one of 11, and then each of those siblings have a lot of kids. And we just resort to levels. Like, my grandparents are level one. My dad's a level two. That makes me a level three.
Yeah.
If I'd have kids. And so at our family reunions, which are like ginormous, literally different colored t-shirts, so you know who's a level two and who, you're like, whose kid is that? And you're like, I don't know, they're in a yellow shirt, they're level four. So it helps us. A lot of people wanted to know about the reliability of sites like Ancestry. Maggie Fraser, who's a first-time question asker, wants to know about reliability. Michelle Miner, Lisa, M, Kendall Burnell, Jesse Cole, Bennett Garber, who's also a first-time question asker, Deanna Wan, and Hannah H. They all kind of want to know, can we rely on these?
Yes.
Yeah? Cool. Good question.
Very good question. Yeah. I have heard of different comments about different companies, and you definitely want to do your research and, you know which company, whatever company you choose to go with, know a little bit about and their ratings and how they're doing, how the people feel about them. And I've heard some things about Ancestry, pros and cons. So I have heard that, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm going to find out because I'm getting ready to take my test with Ancestry, so I will know. But I have heard that they ask you different questions about, you know, putting in a profile. And so you start putting in names like, well, this is my grandfather, this is my grandmother, my great grandfather, boom, boom, boom. He was born in Maryland or, you know, Jackson, Mississippi, whatever. And if someone else on the other, another part of the country, they go in there and they, if one of their names matches with yours, just on the family tree, not the DNA part, but just the profiles, they seem to, they'll send a message back and forth to each other that you might want to look at this person. This person might be interested or might be related to you just by the names that you put on your profile. And so that's kind of something that makes you wonder, you be careful because you may not have been able to fully establish those names that you're putting on your profile if they really are truly related to you. I mean, unless you have concrete proof, no problem. But if you're a genealogist and you're doing the family tree and you've been following the paper trail, you know, the old school methodology, that's just what it says on paper that these are your family. But how do you really know? You know, how, what if somebody was, had a child out of wedlock, you know? So, you know, be aware because that could throw you into, the wrong direction. If just because you match another person's profile, just based on the names, that may not, it may or may not, you know, hold water, but if you take the DNA test and you're connected, well, then you have something to work with. But so I kind of was like, well, if I take this Ancestry test, I'm not going to put any names right yet on my profile. I'm going to just wait and see who pops up first. And then I'll go from there because I don't want too many people, you know, it might give me the wrong leads. You know what I'm saying? So, do your research and just kind of know what company that you choose to go with.
You know, along that line, a lot of listeners like Aaron, Jess Lynn, Maria Kumro, and Conchetta Gibson, Jess Lynn is a first-time question asker, all asked about surnames. Jess Lynn asked that there's mentions that there's a law in Quebec, Canada that forbids a woman from taking her husband's surname after marriage, and asks, are there any cultures or countries in which women traditionally don't take their husband's name, and does that ever cause issues when tracing back families?
Wow, yeah, totally. I have heard that too, that there are some cultures where they, it's a maternal line, and they the female just goes by her maiden name is the surname. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say too that that happens to be a problem a lot in genealogy, not a problem that cannot be overcome. And I have come across that even myself in my own research. Say I find a person on the census, let's say her name is Mary Johnson, just for example. Mm-hmm. But then if you go and you read further in the other columns of Mary Johnson's family line, it says that she's single. But then she has two or three children in her household, listed as son, daughter, whatever, but they are her children. So then you have to ask yourself the question, she's single, but she has children. Okay. And then the children have different names. And so sometimes I've had that problem where I'm trying to figure out, well, Mary Johnson, if I can't find her marriage certificate to show that she that these are her children from her husband, I don't know if she's going, if Mary Johnson is her married name or if that's her maiden name. And so that happens sometimes where you have it's a question mark. That is a really big challenge with genealogy, trying to locate the maiden names. And the best thing that most genealogists are able to do is try to find a marriage certificate. And if that doesn't work, then a death certificate sometimes will show the maiden name. And if you can't find the marriage or the death certificate, it's going to be a tough one.
Just a quick aside. One study showed that in 1980, 98.6% of American women, almost 99%, took their husband's name after marriage. But that's declined in recent years to about 80%. Now, what percent of men adopt a new name after marriage these days? 3%. So this next tip is a revelation.
The other genealogist rule is, look at who's living next door.
Oh.
Look who's living next door, or even a few houses down, because families tended to stay together. Families tend to stay together. And so your family that you found on the census might be living right next door to another family member. And so it's just amazing when you find that connection like that. And yeah, I've found that many times. I've had that discovery and I was like, wow, I've spent 2 years trying to locate and here they were living right next door.
What? Were you there the whole time?
And that kind of brings me to a question a lot of people asked. Anna Thompson, Conchetta Gibson, Jesse Dragon, Margaret Abacher, Rini, Chelsea O'Leary, Sarah Jean Horowitz, and Larissa. Larissa and Chelsea are both first-time question askers. And Larissa asks, what's the best place to start to actually look into family history? What are some questions that we should be asking ourselves and our family and professionals like librarians in order to look into our history?
Great question. Great question. They're all great questions. And obviously your listeners, they're the best. So the first thing to do when you want to get started on your genealogy is, start assembling your family tree, and ask questions from your family if they're still living, if your father is still living, your mother's still living, or grandparents, whoever's the most closest to you that's still alive, even your siblings. Sometimes your siblings have more of a recollection than you do. I know sometimes my brother be coming up with stuff that I don't even remember. And he'd be telling me, and I said, oh, wow, I didn't know that. So just sit down with a pen and paper and just start making a list on the paternal side, your father's side, and the maternal side, your mother's side. And then just start going from there. List your parents first and then list their parents. Put down where they were born, obviously, if you have that information, where they died. If you can find the county name of where they were born or died, that even helps too. Find out what year they were married, like your grandparents. Find out, how did they meet each other? That's always been such a fascinating question to me, is how did the grandparents meet each other? Yeah. Or the great-grandparents, how did they meet each other? Because just because you were born in Chicago, Illinois, and you died in New Orleans, Louisiana, for example, how did great-grandpa meet great-grandma? Or how did grandma meet grandpa? You know, and then you find out, they got married in, Atlanta, Georgia, know, and then that.
What were they doing there?
Right, exactly. That's the point, is what were they doing there? Was their family there in Atlanta? So write all that down of where they got married, because those could be clues later on down the road. They may not mean anything now, but they might later. And so just start putting a chart down, father's side on one side of the paper, mother's side on the other side, and just work your way back on who their grandparents and great grandparents were, and just list as much as you can. And then whatever blanks you have, fill in the blanks by interviewing your relatives and, the aunt and the uncles and the grandmothers and the grandfathers, and try to fill those blanks in as much as you can. And go to the family closet, or wherever, whoever's the one that's holding the records in the family, consult them. You know, there's always somebody in the family that's got all the marriage records. They've got all the pictures, the photographs, the obituaries and the death notices and all that sort of thing, and the birth certificates. So go to that person and just plow through all that and write all that down. Maybe make photocopies if they'll allow you to. When you interview, you know, someone that's really old.
How old?
What does that mean, really old? Sometimes I feel like I'm really old. But when you interview a parent or a grandparent, I even ask them, is it okay if I can record it?
Yeah.
You know, record it. And that way you're not missing anything. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great. And you'll also like learn so much about your family. Who doesn't want to learn more about, you know, people's histories that are right around them? I think that's such a good bonding project too, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So treat yourself to a nice new notebook, brew a pot of tea, and then sit down and interrogate a loved one. Gently. A few people, including Beatriz Belaclava, B. Wilson, and first-time question asker Lizzie, for example, all wanted to know about adoption. And Lizzie asks, my dad is adopted and knows some of his biological family's background, but what does that mean for our genealogy? Do we trace the adopted family's history? Do we trace the bio family's history? Both?
Excellent question. I would say do both if you feel like it. If you have a yearning for wanting to know both, go for it. I know that in my family, my grandfather, who I met, I never did meet my father's parents, so I never did know my paternal grandfather or grandmother. They both passed before I was born. But on my mom's side, my mother remarried. And so her husband was always, he was the one I always called grandpa, but he was not my biological grandpa. But to this day, he will always be my grandfather. And so I did a genealogy search on his family. I wanted to know about him and found out about that he had Native American heritage from Tennessee. And, you know, I found out that he had a Aunt Minerva and she lived to be 100 years old. And I recorded that. I still have that on tape, cassette tape, by the way. I need to update that. So I would say that for adoptions, why not look at both sides, the biological and the adopted side? Absolutely. And for adoptions, I've had people that have contacted me over the years that have wanted to get help in trying to locate their biological parents.
What about turning over some hefty forensic boulders? I had a few people, Julie Bear, Laura Merriman, Stephanie Berhertes, and first-time question asker, April Perry. April Perry wrote in and said, I'm a forensic scientist, a DNA analyst more specifically, and our field has been all abuzz with genealogy in the past few years as cold cases are being solved using public database searches. And April is curious what your take is, including some possible ethical dilemmas. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, that's been on the news recently here. Some people are kind of leery about putting their DNA information on a website where law enforcement agencies can come in and check into that. And they have cold cases where they're trying to solve and you might know some information about it. It's kind of scary, you know? I don't know. That's a good question. If it can create closure to someone, I wouldn't mind participating in solving something, but of course I wouldn't want anything to to turn back on me, you know. But I'm clean. I haven't done anything, so I'm good. I have a clean conscience. But I guess, you know, you have to think about that. If you when you take a DNA test, you're susceptible to whatever is out there. So, you know, just be careful. I know there's a lot of pros and cons on that. That's a very, very big question right now.
It's such a new quandary. It's such a new ethical dilemma that we've just never encountered before. So I think a lot of people are still wrapping their brains around the benefits of getting closure or apprehending someone versus the how, from a molecular level, invasive that is on, you know, some of your actual genes. So yeah, it's really interesting. I think a lot of people are probably super ambivalent, meaning, you know, they're just seeing the good and the bad. And Rachel C. wrote in, she had a great question, and said, I've heard that out of a group of three people, two black and one white, it is just as likely for a black and white person to be more related as it is for the two black individuals to be more closely related. If that is really the case, then what the heck is race anyway, and why does it persist in modern times?
That is so true. That is so true. I mean, race is just, it's just a classification. I mean, even now we have, when we fill out forms, they have check boxes where you can mark whatever ethnicity you wish, but they're becoming more where you can mark that you're a biracial and even triracial. And so that's a problem for the government. They want to have solid data so that they know who's in our country and da-da-da. But
yeah.
I say, hey, why not just embrace all? Why do you have to pick one or the other
right.
when you have so many that are part of your DNA? So, you know, I have to admit, I've been just picking the one, African-American. But there was a few times where I did pick biracial because I am, if I can remember my ratio, I am... I'll just round it off. I'm about 80% African and about 18% European, which right. includes Scandinavian, British, and then 2% Native American and Southeast Asian, which blew me away. So I'd like to learn a little bit more about the Southeast Asian part, you know, the Philippines, Vietnam, type like that, and the Native American part. Love to learn more about my Native American ancestry. In regards to that, race is just a classification. We're all related. And it's interesting, the book that I just recently came out with, 1619, 20 Africans, one of the points I mentioned in the book is that when those Africans came to Virginia in the year 1619, they didn't come as slaves as we know it as slaves that come to our mind. They were indentured servants. And so they didn't have the designation of being slaves. So what that meant was indentured servants, just like those that were coming from England, they worked for a certain period of time. They were indentured to their employer. And so those Africans were indentured. Once they served their time, they were given their freedom, just like all the other indentured servants. Virginia wasn't until 1705 is when the slavery laws, you know, the really hardened slavery laws came into being, was in the year 1705. So prior to that, there were a lot of African-American families in colonial America, colonial Virginia, who were not slaves. They were not under slavery. They had a hard life. Yes, they had a very hard life. Many of them were taken advantage of, no doubt about it, but they were not classified as slaves. So what I'm going with this is that many of these Africans, as they had children and their children had children, there was probably about two or three generations of African Americans who were free in this country before, and I've got before in big, large letters, before the slavery laws were even enacted. Mm-hmm. And that's huge. And a lot of people don't know about that. And I didn't know about it until I took my DNA test and found out that I was related to some of these early African-American families. And so what I also found out was that a lot of the African families that were free in the early part of our colonial history, they were intermarrying with the Irish, with the Native Americans, with the Germans. They were intermarrying. They were becoming a family. And so, but many of the American families that are in this country today, whatever surname you want to use, Johnson, Smith, whatever, if your family's been in this country for, you know, going back to colonial times or even the American Revolution times, chances are you are a mixed family. Chances are you're a mixed family. You know, mm-hmm. in some way, shape, or form, in one way or another, in Native American, or, you know, it's because it's just a fact. But that is not taught in our schools. It's not taught in our history books that there were at least two or three generations of free people before slavery laws even were passed. Virginia is kind of what everybody looks to as the mother of the slavery laws, and everyone, the other states looked at Virginia, you know, whatever they passed, they'll pass. But yeah, there was quite a few years, quite a few decades before slavery even got entrenched. And so that allowed a lot of families to have freedom. There was a lot of African families that were able to buy land. You couldn't do that as a slave. You couldn't buy
right.
land. They could sit on juries. They could barter and trade. It was just, and a lot of people just don't know the history of that. And so, again, there was a lot of intermarriage. A lot of the Africans were marrying Irish women and Scottish women because there mm-hmm. was a shortage of African women. And so there was a lot of intermixture in our society today. And so your listener brings up a very good question there, that, you know, chances are, If you have three people, and if you're white and the other one's black, you're probably more related, just as much related as the two persons that are of the same race. Definitely.
And was that a discovery also that you made in your own family with your sister-in-law?
Yes, my sister-in-law. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, my sister-in-law, this blew me away, is, this is a perfect example, is my wife's sister, which would be my sister-in-law, she has children. And we went to go visit one time, and we're sitting around the breakfast table there in a restaurant and chit-chatting. And my sister-in-law's daughter says, well, yeah, I can remember old grandma. You know, she was from Mississippi, and she used to cook so well. And I remember all these different dishes she would make. She said she was from Jackson, Mississippi. And her and I said, oh, really? Well, what was her name? And she said, well, she was Grandma Grantham. Her maiden name was Grantham. And I almost fell off my chair. I said, Grantham? That's a name that's come up in my family research. Well, when I get back home, I'm going to look that up, because that's very interesting. I said, so maybe some of my family members maybe knew, your grandmother's family. So when I got back home that night, and I went through the records, and I said, I'll be doggone, but these, my sister-in-law's children are related to me. Because when I took my 23andMe test, there was one genetic cousin that we had a connection with. This was like 2011. And me and her, we had communication back and forth, trying to figure out how we were connected. We couldn't figure out a thing. But she sent me her family tree, and her family name was Grantham. Her ancestors were Grantham. It was just amazing.
In his book, 1619, Stephen writes of the encounter, quote, "We might be related. We joked. I was black and they were white. When I later got home, I looked up the information my sister-in-law's daughter gave me about her paternal grandmother. Turns out it wasn't a joke, after all, that my sister-in-law's children and I were related. So if everyone learns a little about their genealogy, chatter over waffles is about to get way more interesting. If you hadn't asked over breakfast what was her name, you'd never would have known that.
Never would have known that. Never would have known that. Yeah.
If you weren't Sherlock Holmes,
man,
spirit, and like, wait a second, get your notepad up. Yeah.
And we embraced it. We just loved that little facet. I mean, we loved each other even before we knew that, but that just kind of, put a little spice into our conversations now every time we meet, and we can bring that up. And so it's just a wonderful thing. And, race is just, color is just, nothing. It's just a classification. We are all related.
Stephen says that the next book he's working on, which will be his third, will get deeper into how we're all related. And I realized just then that this episode would come out near the start of Black History Month, which is in part a celebration of the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln and abolitionist Frederick Douglass. I told Stephen that International Women's Day kind of pisses me off, because it's like, hi, here's your 365th share of the year pie. And I asked him if he feels that way about February. Like, this country was literally built by people of color. But it was conceived first by history professor Carter Woodson in the 1920s and finally recognized by Gerald Ford in the 1970s. Stephen says that he too feels it should be more than a month, but that
I think it's just a good opportunity to educate people, all of us, even for everyone. Everyone. When I say everyone, I mean including African American. Everyone to be educated, re-educated about just getting along with one another. Martin Luther King Jr. said that.
That one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners, will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream.
You know, we don't judge one another based on the color of our skin, but on the basis of our character. And so that's what it's all about, is just embracing one another and just getting closer as a human family, because we need each other. This world is, has its ups and downs, as we know. Mm-hmm. And so we all need to stick together and just be civil. And I think about, colonial America and how, when the first Africans came here, I shouldn't say the first African American. That's going to be something coming out of my next book. Who were the first? But, those that came in 1619, how they were just treated, just like everybody else. And then the slavery laws came along and just took away everything they had. But think of the Native Americans and what they've gone through. I mean, goodness gracious. And that's why I'm really interested to want to learn about that. But yeah, Black History Month is, I think, is still needed to as an opportunity to talk about things that we need to talk about, to acknowledge and to heal. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, from the biggest issues to perhaps some sillier or petty difficulties in the job of genealogy. And the last two questions I always ask every guest is, what is the hardest thing about genealogy or the most annoying thing? Is it waterlogged books? Anything that just is really difficult about genealogy or this just maybe pesters you at all? Even if it's petty.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that kind of irks me is someone will take their DNA test. They will log on to the website. They will download their data. They will click, yes, I do want my information to be posted on this website. Here's my email address. And then when you connect and you find out that, oh, I'm related to this person, I would like to know more about you because some of the names that you have on your profile match my family. And then you reach out to that person and they don't even reply back. That one just really gets me. I mean, why did you want to put your email address on there in the first place? You know, if you're not going to correspond. So that one makes sense. Yeah.
So if anyone ever gets an email from a long lost relative, reply to them.
Yes.
It's worth it. Do not sit on that email. What is your favorite thing about genealogy? What just fills you with butterflies or just makes you love it?
Wow. The thing that makes me always love genealogy is being able to go on the hunt, go on the search to try to find someone's brick wall, someone who, you know, and what I mean by brick wall for any of your listeners is you just come into a point where you can't go any further in your research.
Gotta break through it somehow.
You've come to a brick wall. You've exhausted all your avenues and you just don't know where to go. You just don't know who this person is, where they were, who their parents were or whatever the question is. And I just love to take that brick wall and try to see if I can go through it. I just love that. And, you know, just taking on that challenge. And then once you find him, you're like, oh, yes. It's just wonderful. Love it.
Do you wear a cape? Do you have a big pipe and a cake?
I got a cape on right now. No, I'm just kidding.
A big mustache. Yeah. One of those hunter hats.
Right. With the old pipe. Yeah. No.
So find the most wonderful, smart people and ask them the stupidest questions. And before you know it, you might be sitting on a plane and discover that the person next to you is your fifth step cousin-in-law, four times removed. And you'll kind of know what that means. And you might know them the rest of your life. So to get copies of Stephen Hank's books, you can go to the links in the show notes or Inkwater Press. You can also find links to the sponsor URLs and blackpast.org in the show notes. We are at Ologies on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Allie Ward with one L on both. So follow along. Let's be friends. Ologies merch is available at AllieWard.com. Thank you to Shannon Feltis and Bonnie Dutch of the podcast. You are that. They manage the merch. And thanks to Aaron Talbert for adminning the Ologies podcast Facebook group. Thank you, Jarrett Sleeper of the mental health podcast, My Good Bad Brain, for the assistant editing. And of course, to a guy who's like a bro, Stephen Ray Morris, who hosts the Purrcast and See Jurassic Right, which are about kitties and dinosaurs. Nick Thorburn of the band Islands wrote and performed the theme music. And you know, if you stick around past the credits, you get a secret. And this week, I'm going to tell you, I drove to an ex-boyfriend's house in the middle of the night. We dated for 4 months a decade ago. But in the parking lot of the apartment complex, I remember there was a lemon tree that was overloaded with fruit way back then. And this was not just any lemon tree. This is a Meyer lemon tree, which we all know has way better lemons. Regular lemons are like a Mounds bar. Meyer lemons, they're like an almond joy. They're just better. I think technically there's some type of orange, but the point is, from memory, I drove through the LA Hills alone at 10 p.m. I felt like such a creep. And I found the side street and the lemon tree was still there with literally hundreds of Meyer lemons. So I took maybe 8 or 10. I put them in a hat and I ran back to my car. Now, granted, He hasn't lived there in like 10 years, but it still felt dangerous and skeevy and very thrilling to have a bowl of the best lemons on my counter. I've been pulverizing them in a pitcher and drinking it as lemonade, and then I eat their ragged flesh and skin like a buzzard. Also, if fruit overhangs a fence, technically it's legal to pick. Also, no one's gonna ever eat all those lemons. There's so many lemons. Okay, so good. All right, bye-bye.
Pachydermatology. Homeology. Cryptozoology. Lithology. Nanotechnology. Meteorology.
Believe they